Welcome back to The Popular Show with me, James A. Smith. This is our first recording of 2024. We are the podcast that gets the best guests. If you want us to carry on, get over to patreon.com/thepopularpod and give us some support. You can get the exclusive full version of my debate with Doug Lane about the left's Gaza response there. And you can also hear from David Gardner, who is has been an editor at Newsweek, foreign correspondent for the Daily Mail, biographer of Tom Hanks, and the author of these indispensable books that I have in front of me, 9/11, The Conspiracy Theories, and COVID-19, The Conspiracy Theories. David, thanks so much for making some time for us on The Popular Show.
Oh, good to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Appreciate you inviting me.
It's great to have you here. I mean, as new evidence of conspiratorial behavior or new emphasis on claims of conspiracies in news items increase, the salience of older conspiracy theories seems to grow. I mean, at the moment we've got the opening of the court records of the Jeffrey Epstein case going on. October 7th in Israel and Gaza, it seems like that has been on a sort of speed run of what happened to the way 9/11 gets talked about, this sort of struggle over interpretation of those events. I wanted to mention as well that last year, a relatively apolitical or sort of soft left friend of mine said, why is it that so many guys who were really into Corbyn a few years ago are really into the Kennedy assassination now? I think that across the political spectrum, there's a new sort of attention to these sort of issues and these sort of events that in the past have been a bit of a kind of crank minority interest. So I'm really glad we could get you on to talk about conspiracy theory today. Maybe we'll start with the difference between the two books, the 9/11 one and the COVID one. Do you feel something's changed between those two projects that you embarked upon? Was there something different about the kinds of belief and the kinds of people that you were investigating in the 9/11 book and the COVID book?
Yeah, sure. And it touches on exactly what you were just pointing out. It's the internet, really. 9/11, internet was in its infancy. We were in the old days where you pretty much read and believed what you read. People, you know, it's an old fallacy that people always say, I never believe what I read on the newspapers. I never believe what I see on TV. And they kind of do, because that's at that time, probably up until the last 10, 20 years, that's all you really had to believe in. Most people hadn't been to Iraq. They hadn't been to, you know, these foreign parts of the world. They didn't really know the story. So they may have been cynical or skeptical about some of these stories, but you pretty much, there was an essence of it which you believed, because you didn't have a lot of choice. And at that time, as is now, most public outlets, most newspapers, most websites, even now, have an agenda. So you perhaps chose your outlet because of your own beliefs, but generally it's kind of a more, you know, it's a sneaking agenda. People wouldn't always be totally aware of it. Now, of course, the internet doesn't have an agenda. It's all over the place. It's everywhere. It's every belief, every crackpot theory, it's all out there. So people can find their own beliefs in their own bedroom. It's not so difficult. So to answer your question, 9/11, we kind of believe what we read initially. I think it was a slow moving idea that people started to question things. I mean, obviously some people privately questioned it, but publicly not so much. With the pandemic, it was an infodemic, really. People were questioning things immediately. You know, you got the whole vaccine controversy, and that was around within minutes, days, or whatever, of the vaccine being announced. So it's very much a speed thing. And I think that that's pretty much why we read so much about conspiracy theories now. And perhaps before it was more of a kind of a private conversation, water cooler topic. Now it's everywhere.
You remark in the COVID book that the substantive difference between COVID conspiracy theories and virtually every previous example is that the others were all in some way retrospective, like trying to get to the bottom of some event, what Peter Dale Scott would call a deep event that has occurred even in the recent past that we believe has been misrepresented or disguised in some way, and we're trying to find out the truth. The COVID was the first example of a sort of live conspiracy production where something that was by no means concluded, something that was still happening, was being theorized in real time. I suppose that was only really possible with this joined up communication system of the internet as well, really.
Yeah, it's great and it's terrible at the same time, because you've got some amazing things coming out. People are questioning things live as it happens. People are changing things. I mean, the whole Wuhan lab theory leak, that was a conspiracy theory. And then suddenly President Biden is investigating it. So it's not a conspiracy theory. That's the great thing about conspiracy theories, that they suddenly stop being conspiracy theories when they prove to be correct, which is often the case. It's easy to criticize and say and blame, attack people as conspiracy theorists until it turns out that they were actually correct in the first place.
A peculiarity of the pandemic was that not only was it the case that something that was denounced as a conspiracy theory one day would become acknowledged as the truth, just maybe a few weeks later. Another sort of strange phenomenon that we really felt doing this show through COVID was realizing that when you're speaking to people in other countries, what is regarded as a conspiracy theory in the present can be different from country to country. So you could be talking to Americans who are kind of behind the British mainstream press in entertaining the lab leak theory, for example. So in Britain, it's a respectable Times report or opinion that maybe there's a lab leak. In America, you're still a crazy Trumper if you believe that. And there were many elements of the COVID response and many kind of arguments about COVID that fit that pattern. It was as if in every country, respectable, educated people disapproved of conspiracy theories as such, but there just wasn't consistency about what constituted a conspiracy theory. You could believe something in one country but not in another and be respectable.
Yeah, and I also find it politically it was so polarizing and awkward in some ways, because the right wing were complaining about the kind of personal freedoms being taken away. At the same time, the left wing found themselves kind of defending mandatory restrictions on face masks and things, which are probably more likened to a kind of dictatorship or something. It was people were thrown in these difficult situations defending sometimes things they didn't even necessarily want to defend. It was a difficult and strange time in that respect.
It's often observed that conspiracy theorist itself as a coinage and as a way of describing certain activities, that this was coined in the 60s after the Kennedy assassination. And what I don't know, the argument is that it's almost a conspiracy in itself to delegitimize kinds of inconvenient questioning by making it seem like any questioning of official narratives is identical with the most deranged evidence-free outsider thinking. Is it fair to say that there was something of that dynamic during COVID too, that the fact that nobody wanted to be thought of as a anti-vaxxer, nobody wanted to be thought of as a COVID denier, that sort of pressurized a lot of people on the left and a lot of people in sort of professional class jobs? It incentivized them to kind of close their ears to actually very legitimate criticisms and even foreclosed on actually anyone saying, well, maybe there are other ideas about how we could deal with this pandemic, other responses we could do. Maybe we can use some of these healthy people who aren't at great risk from COVID and are currently just playing Xbox. Maybe they could be useful in some way in this national crisis.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. And I think the idea that the great thing about conspiracy theories per se, I mean, it's really questioning authority, which is we are able to do in a way we were never able to do before. It was, you know, you could be a politician, you could be in the media, but really the average person couldn't really question what was going on around them. And what the media, what the internet has allowed us to do is to put those views forward and to be heard to a certain extent. The problem is, of course, there are going to be the crackpot theories amongst them. I mean, so you're going to get things taken to extremes. You're going to get those old, the anti-Semitism, the kind of the very bad side of this kind of whole arena. They're going to push to the fore. But it is a platform to raise legitimate questions, as you say. I mean, I found it, the pressure during the conspiracy, during the whole pandemic. It was even the case where if you weren't vaccinated, that became socially difficult to talk about. Whereas perhaps when you went online, that gave it a forum for people to discuss some of those things.
Yeah, it's self-perpetuating, isn't it? That if you sort of bring in these norms overnight with relatively little explanation, absolutely no democratic oversight or debate, and say, well, right, this is happening now, and if you don't agree, you're, you know, on a continuum with the worst people in the world, and you want to kill Granny, etc. Yes. That is going to force people into sort of silos that become self-perpetuating, where you, you say, oh, well, it looks like my brothers are these crazy people on the internet now, and I'm going to just kind of go down this rabbit hole. Yeah. I think to a great extent, our information economy and the way it is managed and policed produces as much conspiratorialism as it prevents.
Yeah, I mean, fun enough, as an author, I mean, there was a certain dilemma because I'm not a conspiracy theorist. You know, I don't have any kind of wild theories. My idea with these books was to examine the theories and examine and find out what truth I could find in them. Mm-hmm. And I suspect had my books been more, had more conspiracy in them, and I'd been a bit more kind of attached to these conspiracies, they would have sold more, because I think probably people picked up the books to a certain extent, and some would probably be disappointed that I didn't have some crazier outlandish views. I was trying to present the conspiracies rather than support them. And you know, some of these videos, Loose Change, this video of 9/11, I've seen millions of times. You know, people have made a lot of money and publicity out of some of the more outlandish ideas.
Okay, well, I have to say that I almost had the reverse experience with your books, in that I, being one of those Corbyn guys who got into the Kennedy assassination, I had been reading a lot of Peter Dale Scott, who we've had on the program before. He's 94 years old now. And I'd been increasingly convinced by these arguments that so much of the history of the second half of the 20th century, getting into the 21st century, that you couldn't really understand it in the way that, like, Bernie Sanders people and Corbyn people had tried to, which was, if people just hear our arguments for a more left economy honestly presented, and they get the chance to, they'll vote for us, and then we'll make society better because our ideas make sense. Mm. Once you start listening to an analysis of all of that kind of long history since the 60s that Peter Dale Scott gives, you come to the view that actually any outsider political project of the right or the left just wouldn't be allowed to win, and that there have been these sort of reset, even with the most conservative analysis of the facts and the evidence, you have to conclude that there is some, like, direction of travel in our governments that is profoundly anti-democratic and actually has a great fear of democracy itself. And once you started sort of seeing things that way, you become a lot more open to stuff that your sensible, you know, university background or whatever has made you somehow immune to or not at all generous to. Anyway, I then thought, okay, maybe I need to read something a little bit more skeptical and unconvinced on this. I'll go to David Gardner. I get a book that, you know, goes through some of these conspiracy theories about 9/11 and gives the sort of the sensible minded refutation. Actually, I found myself really having my eyes opened about quite a lot of the stuff around 9/11 that I'd really ignored. I mean, the World Trade Center 7, the BBC 20 minutes, you know, reporting on the destruction of World Trade Center 7 20 minutes before it actually happened. I'd totally forgotten about that. The fact that the first responders, all the testimonies you give from firefighters who were there, who were convinced that there was some sort of, you know, they were witnessing explosives going off as opposed to a kind of trauma to the buildings from the planes hitting. All of these architects and engineers who see it in terms of a controlled explosion. I suppose that was stuff that I'd kind of put out of my mind and thought, well, you know, the more plausible stuff is, you know, that there was some element of this that was permitted to happen. Authorities knew it was going to happen, et cetera, et cetera. But the only the crazy people believe that it was a controlled explosion and that jet fuel doesn't melt steel beams. Actually, I found that you were much more. I was phrasing this as a question. Did you find yourself being more generous to that point of view than you'd maybe anticipated you would be? I felt like I was reading a book by a man who had got much more convinced by a lot of the things he was writing on than he'd set out to be.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, these aren't kind of people who, with no knowledge at all. The architects and engineers group, all pretty, I mean, there's lots of them, hundreds of them, and they're all kind of supporting this with scientific evidence. I mean, the trouble is with this and other like things, it takes you down that rabbit hole, which is very conspiracy theory. You have to think, okay, that makes a lot of sense. The demolition theory, the fact these bombs, these explosions are going off in places you wouldn't expect them to go off, particularly in Building 7, which was, 360 yards away from the towers, wasn't hit by a plane, was just supposedly hit by debris on bits of kind of burning rubble.
And that's shot straight down.
Yeah. And that dropped it in seven seconds, the whole building collapsed. Crazy when you think about it. But the rabbit hole is, why were they? Who put these bomb explosives there? What was this whole demolition plan? You know, why were certain people supposedly told to be off work that day? There's all these theories. And then you have to kind of take it to the logical conclusion. And then that takes you back to slightly to the crazier edge of things where you're thinking, you know, could the American government be involved? I mean, which I can't accept. So you're kind of left in limbo somewhere, really.
I'll give listeners a representative paragraph. So this is 9/11, the conspiracy theories. Despite my lack of faith in the government's 9/11 narrative, I still find it impossible to believe the president or the vice president was a party to an unconscionable plot that would take so many American lives. But as you read this fascinating transcript provided through the Freedom of Information Act, please note that there were just two sections that were redacted from the tapes, 30 minutes of cockpit recordings from flights 93 and a conference call between Cheney, Rumsfeld and other high level officials. And then there's a long quotation of transcripts of the exchanges between pilots and officials and so on in the run up to the plane's impacts. There are many moments in the book where you take that tone. I can't believe that the only explanation, and yet, have you embraced the limbo there? It's almost as if. I feel this a lot about the sort of stuff that Robert Kennedy Jr. Comes out with now. We hear a lot about why he's wrong about vaccines and why he's wrong about autism and wrong about the effect of pollution, on children, et cetera, et cetera. But then in every case, there is a legitimate question there. It's as if shutting down the conspiracy theory therefore also shuts down the fact that there's something that needs an explanation here.
Mm. Yeah. I guess my answer would be, my defense would be that I don't know the answer. So that's the honest answer. But where I'm more passionate about is that I absolutely think there was a cover up with 9/11, and I think that's the kind of core of the why it's endured so long. And I think lack of transparency is one of the biggest things that fuels conspiracy theories. I mean, we still talk about the lab leak in Wuhan because no one's ever told us it was or wasn't that, because there is a lack of transparency in China. We're still talking about 9/11, really, the reasons behind it, because there's a lack of transparency. The US government has never really answered very fundamental questions about 9/11 and the lead up to it. And what astonished me when I first started researching that particular book was the sheer numbers of families. These are families of survivors, the survivors themselves, families of the dead, more than 6,000 people involved in two lawsuits against Saudi Arabia, which in effect is also against their own government, because it's basically asking questions, unanswered questions, about the lead up to 9/11, why there isn't more clarity about the movements and the behavior of the hijackers who were in the country more than a year before the bombings. The plane attacks. Those questions haven't been answered still, and these families are still trying to get a reasonable answer as to what happened to their loved ones. And we kind of forget about, this is a long time ago, but this is the biggest civil lawsuit in US history, and it's still going on. And and it's not covered. It's not of any, I guess, interest to the media now. But to those families who all lost so much 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago, it's still very, very much in their minds. So no, I don't have all the answers to these things. I don't know who killed JFK, although, again, cover up, undoubtedly. But I think the cover up is something we can examine. I feel passionate about that. And I feel passionate about the lack of transparency throughout government, throughout in the establishment, that kind of fuels these questions. And that fuels the zanier side of it. Sure, because people don't have anything to relate to, they can come up with crazy theories and no one can really question them.
The importance of the families of the victims of 9/11. That is an important point. The stereotype of the 9/11 truther is often the sort of stereotype of the Fox News addict, latterly the MAGA Trump supporter, January 6th sort of guy. But really, the demand for answers and the accusations of a cover-up of 9/11 has come from these campaign groups that are actually the victims. In Europe, it's easy to look back on all of that jingoism of the W. Bush period and the war on terror and to think of the American victim complex around 9/11 as this very anti-Muslim thing, this very pro-war thing. But the people who are the most immediate victims almost immediately kind of turns their primary attention and their primary aggression against their own government. That is one of many ingredients, actually, of the most recent crisis and most recent comparable event, October 7th, in Israel, Gaza, where we find again the most vociferous critics of Netanyahu and the most vociferous skeptics of the Israeli narrative are the families of people killed on October 7th, Israelis killed on October 7th, and the families of the Hamas hostages, and that's only one example of a parallel. Quite apart from the fact that this is a huge mass murder event that appears to be being deployed. Some people will say rightly, but nonetheless, it is being deployed as the pretext for a pretty massive escalation in foreign policy aggression. We have here, you know, stuff that it took years to come into the narrative around 9/11 has come in a matter of months. We've got it all. We've got the short stocks immediately before October 7th, just as with 9/11. We've got evidence of multiple sources of intelligence warning that it was going to happen. That almost immediately that was revealed that Netanyahu's government had been told it was going to happen. We have the standing down of troops, that transfer of troops from Gaza to the West Bank, and also the sort of mysterious shutting down of electronic defense systems, the immediate deleting and erasing of key bits of videotape, key records, in the very scene of the October 7th massacre itself. Cars that there's questions over whether it was Israel whether the IDF destroyed them or whether Hamas destroyed them. We're reassured that out of respect for the dead, those cars are going to be destroyed immediately. All of the, even if you take the most kind of conservative reading of this, it is just remarkable to see stuff that, you know, basically the portrait of the 9/11 truth kind of arguments that you give in your book, that took, you know, decades or more to come together. We already have a pretty extraordinary dossier on October 7th. And the stuff I'm saying here isn't coming from cranks on the internet. It's coming from Haaretz, most of it, from the liberal paper of Israel. I don't know, were you sort of, what were your sort of feelings? Were your ears pricking up as you were watching the coverage come in of October 7th?
Yeah, very much so. And even to the extent that people are, it only happened a few months ago. People are already denying it ever happened. I mean, which is, again, followed through with 9/11. That was one of the more extreme ideas that there was no, it was all a big conspiracy between the government and the media, and the thing never happened. It's, people are saying that now about October the 7th. Yeah, and it's just, I think it just shows, again, goes back to the internet and how quickly everything is, how dynamic the situation is, really. Everyone, I mean, for instance, that the idea that the Israelis stepped down and allowed it to happen, you know, to escalate the situation in the Middle East. I mean, a lot of that derives from a report in the New York Times saying that there was this warning a year earlier, the Jericho Wall warning. I mean, so it's essentially, it's people seizing on facts, I guess, and then distorting them for their own purposes, or, you know, or using for their own sort of propaganda purposes, really. And the speed with which it's happened, and I guess it, with any major event, this is going to be a pattern, I'm sure, as we move forward. There's so many people looking at what's going on and then using whatever information they have to push their own particular agendas.
Do you think elites deserve conspiracy theories? Because they act in a conspiratorial manner, what we do know about so much of the 20th century and after is so outlandish in itself that as I say, the straightforward empirical conservative record on MK Ultra, on Watergate, on MI6 surveillance on Harold Wilson, on Iran-Contra, on the role of the CIA in drug trafficking, on Jeffrey Epstein letting Kevin Spacey sit on the throne here in Britain. It makes it preposterous, actually, to rule out conspiracy theories as such. I mean, the Warren Commission report on the Kennedy assassination now bears so little resemblance to what you can read about the Kennedy assassination on the White House website. Sure. The pattern is always, we get the official report, and then gradually things are revealed or things are declassified, and gradually that initial report gets eroded and eroded until it is simply a work of fiction. Yeah. And it should be said, the only people who still believe in its narrative are usually elite educated professionals. The only people who still believe the lone gunman theory of the Kennedy assassination are people who've gone to Harvard. The rest of the idiots out there have actually kept more in step with the facts as they go along. The 9/11 Commission report is following exactly the same pattern. And well, I mean, as we watch the figures on Israeli civilians killed on October 7th reduce week on week, it's this sort of speed run pattern. It's just happening faster. You conclude your COVID book with some ideas about the kind of management of information that you'd prefer to see, in contrast to this almost zero-sum battle between extremely secretive and self-defensive elites that do just want the monopoly of control over information versus this unregulated kind of hinterland of information where you sort of feel like you can say anything, and if you say it in a zany enough way, then you're gonna get some traction.
Well, yes, it's I mean, greater minds than mine are trying to work out how to sort this out. I mean, it is a Wild West at the moment, and the likes of Elon Musk don't make it any easier, because they're kind of as crazy as everybody else. But I would like to see some more controls without censorship, if that makes any sense. The thing about conspiracy theories, it's used as a pejorative term now. I don't think it should be, because I think, it is people asking questions legitimately. And I think what you said about the elites is very fair and very correct for centuries, really. I mean, the average person has not been given the information it should, it's been kept important information about their lives has been kept from them. I think that in the last 20 years, the internet has challenged that status quo. The establishment doesn't have the control that it used to have. And that establishment may take different forms in different countries. I mean, American has a different establishment than the UK, and every country has its own. But in every nation, I would say the establishment, its power source is probably secrecy, because that's where it has that power to act. Now, I mean, we've even seen with Boris Johnson and the kind of number 10 and the people who controlled the COVID, they're being taken to task publicly. And a lot of things that were said during the pandemic, they're now having to answer questions about now. I genuinely think those questions wouldn't have been raised. Were we not in the sort of very situation where people can also open, have an open access to debate in a way they didn't have before?
Yeah, and I think that's a good warning to people whose mindset about censorship is do it for people I disagree with, if you see what I mean. There are just a lot of people who take the view that when it's my side, we're asking legitimate questions. When it's your side, you're coming up with crank conspiracy theories. I guess to take another example that you treat in the COVID book, the election conspiracy theories in the US and culminating in January 6th, and indeed the fact that huge numbers of people in the States do not accept the result of the 2020 election. I feel that those good liberals who want to see those people booted off the internet were happy to see Trump booted off the off of Twitter around January 6th, and want to see American officials all the way up to Trump kept off ballots and excluded from democracy if they don't accept the 2020 election. All those people would be on surer footing if they'd accepted the 2016 election. But the fact is that educated liberals in the US spent the entire post-2016 period making up their own, albeit better healed, kind of conspiracy theories, but no less outlandish, that Trump had had been pissed on by a prostitute in Russia and this had been filmed, and Putin had won the election for him in order to blackmail him in government. This is just as crazy as QAnon, and as far as we know, as baseless. It was just, as it were, a sort of a different kind of class aesthetic. If you're a Clinton person, then this is how you do your conspiracy theorizing. If you're a Trump person, you put on the moose ears and you storm the Capitol. Both of these are a different sort of class aesthetics for the same impulse. And it's the impulse of, I no longer trust institutions. Institutions, as far as I can see, have broadly betrayed me and act in a totally secretive manner that makes me paranoid about them. This isn't just the kind of preserve of your stereotypical Trump supporter or right-wing zealots. This is obviously being felt at all kind of segments of society. And depending on what the crisis is, depending on what the kind of moment or even just news cycle is, different groups will sort of seize a kind of conspiratorial discourse for themselves. The problem is that only one of those groups really has control of the censorship apparatus. It was the Biden administration that was telling Twitter to kick, you know, Oxford and Stanford academics off of the platform because of what they said about COVID. We sort of have a problem that censorship is politicized and it is being deployed largely against, I don't know. Well, when Matt Taibbi came on this program, he said that he had officials sort of telling him, leaking to him, that they'd gone from being told that counterterrorism is the thing to being told counterpopulism is the thing. That the problem is the left and the right, people who are too extreme in either direction, these are who we need to be dedicating our time to shutting down.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who have quite strong views on a lot of these matters, it's crazy anymore. I think it's, I mean, people across the garden fence, people, I was surprised during the COVID pandemic, quite how many people felt strongly about some of the conspiracy theories I've written about. And funny enough, even now, when I sit and talk to people socially about 9/11 and some of these ideas, we talk about it, and people who I would think would have very formulaic ideas about it all, it turns out, you know, they believe some of these theories too. Some of the ones that I'm sitting comfortably on the fence about, have very strong feelings about. I mean, I think, like I say, it's a much bigger debate than probably the mainstream would accept. And I think there's a sort of pomposity about the media in terms of conspiracy theories. And I think, you know, for instance, my books weren't really reviewed in the places I would think they might have been. And I even know some of the people who would review them, but it was dismissed. We don't do conspiracy theories. We don't review them. We don't do articles about conspiracy theories. And there's that. I think that runs through the media a little bit, which is basically turning its back. It's segmenting the whole idea of a conspiracy theory in the crackpot. Well, there's a much more to it than that.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that is a great example of the way that the conspiracy theory can often be a quite authentic and honest response to a problem, even if it isn't an empirical or empirically correct one, if you see what I mean. When people say the media is a cabal, that the media is you know, manufacturing consent and so on, they, in many cases, they won't literally mean that all the editors get together and agree what the line is going to be and say, okay, this, the Guardian will win over people this way and the Mail will win over people that way. You know, it's easy for journalists to sort of snort at that kind of image. But I think a lot of people don't literally believe that, or don't even sort of explore whether or not they literally believe that. It's almost like it's a sort of allegorical language for describing like something that is obviously is happening. It's not happening in the conscious planned way that we imagine, where people wear robes and hold torches and so on. It's happening in this more kind of tacit way of editorial lines, of assumed kind of decorums and assumed kind of lines that you don't cross just because you don't need to. No, you know, if your books can't get reviewed, then of course kind of deep, you know, stuff that makes more kind of committed arguments about about conspiratorial arguments are not going to be either. So I don't know, you see what I mean, that yes. Again, it's a case of sort of elites and professionals sort of asking to have theories made up about them.
Yeah I mean, I think there's a certain old-fashioned ethos in the media. I mean, I've worked for pretty much every newspaper as a freelance in the US. I mean, I worked for a long time for the Daily Mail, which obviously has a clear idea of what its audience is. And I think most in the UK, all the main newspapers and media have a fairly clear idea who their market is. I think probably they'd all feel the same about the idea of conspiracy theories and theorists. There'd be something to be kind of pushed out of the way. Because you know, if you get someone turning up at the front door of the Times or the Sun and with a theory about what really happened on October the 7th, they're probably going to usher them politely away. They're not going to write a column on them, you know. But whereas that same person can go and write a blog on the internet, and it may or not, mm-hmm. may or not be read. That's the difference. That's the times we're moving into, I think.
Another sort of thing that strikes me is how quickly the social groups who were supposed to be most worried about falling for conspiracy theories can change. Just a few years ago, it was Trump and Brexit supporters who we were told have all been hypnotized on Facebook. They're spending all their time sat there on Facebook because they're retirees and Facebook algorithms are telling them that they have to vote for Brexit and Trump. Of course, nobody could possibly have their own, you know, conscious political reasons for favoring those things. They must have been tricked, we were told. They must have been tricked. Now it's no longer these sort of, you know, podgy old sorts with their red caps who we're supposed to picture. Now it's Zoomers on TikTok who are in exactly the same fashion getting, hypnotized into being anti-Semitic, into hating Israel. Of course, nobody could possibly have made up their own mind politically that they don't like what they're seeing and don't like what's coming out of Gaza. They must have been tricked. There's a kind of shifting way in which the what we're supposed to imagine as the archetypal conspiracy theorist keeps kind of moving, and there's a sort of conspiratorial dimension to that claim in itself. We sometimes say, China and Russia via TikTok are hypnotizing our youth. That's its own kind of conspiracy theory, just as much as the Zoomer who whatever believes some, you know, Protocols of Zion thing all of a sudden is also a conspiracy theorist.
I mean Russia is trying to change minds and is using the internet to try and infiltrate, I guess, Western thought. That is true. I mean, and they did try and affect the results of elections. There's disinformation going on all the time through Russia, and that's undeniable. But when I was in LA, they were trying to recruit TV staff for some Russian TV channels to try and to give some credibility to some of the theories that they had, and paying reasonable money, but that went on through the pandemic and is presumably going on now. But still, as you say, the whole idea of trying to influence is something that's going on all the time.
Well, David Gardner, thanks so much for taking us through these arguments. I very strongly recommend to our listeners 9/11, The Conspiracy Theories, The Truth and What's Been Hidden From Us, and COVID-19, The Conspiracy Theories, The Truth and What's Been Hidden From Us. And thanks so much for making some time for us on The Popular Show.
I appreciate it, James. Thanks very much.